dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for a bit of a tour of the battle space of what we think of as the war for the free world. We are going to visit with a number of very interesting people on some very important topics, none arguably more so than our first guest. His name is Philip Dunmire. He is the president of an organization I revere, the Navy League of the United States. And it's not just because they were kind enough to award me back in 1999 with a tribute that I will never possibly live up to, named for Alfred Thayer Mahan. Beyond that, they are an extraordinary organization working for the sea services in the United States, and important work it is. Mr. Dunmire is a Vietnam War veteran, highly decorated, a man who, though, interestingly enough, comes to this job of president of the Navy League as an Army veteran. So, Mr. Dunmire, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. I am very keen to get your thinking on, and that of the Navy League, of course, more generally, on what is likely to happen to America's sea services, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, the Merchant Marine, if this so-called sequestration budget axe falls, as now seems likely.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's an honor to be with you today. And I would like to quote, to start with, Secretary of Defense Panetta, who states that such a large cut as this applied in this indiscriminate manner would render most of our ship and construction projects unexecutable.
Wow.
You cannot buy three quarters of a ship. The issue here is that this complicated word sequestration comes into effect in January and will be administered not by the Congress but by the Office of Management and Budget. It's a mindless across the board 8% cut for next year alone, and
on top of the cuts that have already been made, let's remember, something on the order of at least $800 billion, right?
Well, there's $487 billion of cuts spread over 10 years under the Budget Control Act of 2011,
right?
And these cuts for the security forces of the United States would total almost another $500 billion, another $500 billion.
Yeah, but beyond that, there was, as I recall, something like $330 billion that was taken in the first 3 years of the Obama administration, so before we got to the Budget Control Act. But the point you're making really is, and I think that Leon Panetta said very elegantly, is you can't buy three quarters of a ship. The kinds of cuts that they're talking about mindlessly taking would clearly devastate both the shipbuilding aspects of our industrial base and also the Navy itself. How does that translate into real-world capabilities being impacted?
Well, first of all, the Department of Defense has been directed to not plan for sequestration. In other words, there's a hope going on that it won't take into effect, won't come into effect. Initially, it was simply a part of the negotiations last year in Congress with the expectation that this would be so devastating,
right,
that Congress would be forced to find a compromise. In fact, they've not found a compromise, and this risk looms without action.
Well, it's in law, right? It has to be repealed, in effect, or amended to be spared.
And there's no expectation that there won't be some cuts, but the important thing and message that we're trying to get across is that these cuts need to be intelligently applied, not mindlessly applied across the board. The Secretary of the Navy has said, this is Admiral Greener, that just the planning for this, if and when it becomes inevitable, would tie up the service and department personnel so much that it could essentially bring the U.S. military operations to a halt.
Wow.
The General Amos, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, has stated that the Marines, this is a recipe for a hollow force of the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. Coast Guard, which is so important not only domestically but around the world, is already trying to accomplish their 11 missions with many, many ships and cutters that are 40-plus years of age.
Yeah.
They've got an important counterterrorism, counter narcotics, life-saving, fisheries law enforcement, many other missions that they're being expected already to perform with ancient equipment.
Right.
Prone to breakdowns.
In equipment that will, under these budget cuts, almost certainly be even more difficult to maintain, or at least there'll be fewer resources with which to do that. Let me ask
I want to make the point that a potentially devastating aspect of this looming crisis is the impact on the industrial base of the United States.
Yes, I wanted to go there. Good.
The fact is that people are going to be laid off in the next few months in anticipation of these cuts if the Congress does not act.
Mm-hmm.
And many tens of thousands, and I'm sure hundreds of thousands of people, their jobs are at stake. Some of these jobs are critical. They're trained people. And once these people leave and go to other jobs or simply opt to retire or otherwise leave the defense-related industries they're in now, these people are not coming back.
Right.
You can't just snap your fingers and come up with the talent needed to produce the ships, the electronics, all the capabilities that it takes to defend this nation.
Yeah. We're speaking again with Philip Dunmire. He is the national president of the Navy League of the United States. It is a civilian organization that supports these sea services, as we've been discussing, one that does, I think, indispensable work advocating on behalf of those who really can't advocate on their own behalf, those in uniform or enjoined from doing so. Just on the point you were making a moment ago, Philip Dunmire, I'm hearing from people in industry that these kinds of contractions, these kinds of layoffs, reductions in force, whatever you want to call them, are being taken even now. That this is not something that's coming in a couple of months, but in some cases is already beginning to happen. In the shipbuilding business particularly, it wasn't that big to begin with when this whole round of cuts started. Do you anticipate we could get to a point in the foreseeable future where, especially if some of the more draconian things that you've just described, some of our senior military leaders warning of, come about, that we simply will not be able to produce some of the ships that we need, certainly not with the American-supplied equipment that is necessary, and perhaps not even in the final analysis, the assembly and fabrication?
Well, there's no question about it. Of course, when we were attacked on December 7th of 1941, there were many ships under construction, and we were able to complete those ships by 1943 and use them to win the war.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anticipated that the next time around we're going to have a year or two to gear up.
Right.
And certainly if we don't even have the ships and equipment in the pipeline, mm-hmm, being constructed, we're not going to be able to gear up industries on short notice to produce what's needed to defend this nation.
Yeah. This is really the crux of the matter, and we talk about this a lot at Secure Freedom Radio, Mr. Dunmire, as you may know, that these kinds of problems I think most Americans are unaware of and would be horrified to discover that, you know, vital components of their national security, whether it's the folks in uniform and doing the hard jobs that they're doing, or whether it's the people in industry who support them, are in this kind of parlous state. And it's going inexorably forward with no relief in sight with respect to the sequestration business, raising serious questions as to whether we are going to find some of these really dire repercussions eventuating. I appreciate very much the work that you all are doing at the Navy League to raise an alarm about this and to encourage, as I think we all must, our elected representatives to shift direction and preserve the best military in the world, not allow it to be, hollowed out, as the Marine Corps Commandant has put it. We look forward to working with you on this and many other things in the future. And also, we didn't get to it today, but the Law of the Sea Treaty rears its ugly head again, and maybe we can talk with you about that on another occasion. Philip Dunmire, thank you very much for the work that the Navy League is doing. Keep it up. Please keep coming back to us. We look forward to talking with you again.
Frank, if I may, I've got a closing comment that if we have another minute.
We don't have another minute, but go ahead and give it to me, and maybe we can fit it in.
Well, I just want to say that it's easy for us to take for granted our goods and services, which depend upon free commerce on the seas. And the reason our message is so timely here and needed now is that we are a nonpartisan group, and our interest is in seeing that we have a strong Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Navy, and Merchant Marine to defend this country.
Yeah, amen. We may not be able to use that, but we will see what we can do. Thank you again. Next up, we'll be speaking with Stephen Groves of the Heritage Foundation, and we will be talking about the Law of the Sea Treaty with him. Stay tuned.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying they're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined once more, I'm happy to say, by Stephen Groves. He is one of the really up-and-coming stars, I think, in the firmament of the national security public policy community, currently working at the Heritage Foundation, where he is responsible for protecting and preserving American sovereignty, self-governance, and independence. And this is all within his responsibilities under the Heritage Foundation's Freedom Project. A tall order, but if there's anybody who can do it, it is Stephen Groves. Stephen, welcome back. It's good to have you with us. This is kind of now, I guess, becoming a more imminent problem. We've talked about it in the past as a more distant one. Tell us about the current state of play with respect to the Law of the Sea Treaty. We'll need to talk, obviously, about the merits and content of it, but just at the moment, why do we have to talk about this right now?
Thanks for having me on, Frank, and thank you very much for that kind introduction. I hope to live up to to what you promised
you,
for me.
You do every day.
Well, it seems to be coming up imminently, because Senator Kerry, who's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, has been wanting to have hearings on the Law of the Sea Treaty since last fall, but we suspect and we have information to believe that he delayed those hearings because his good friend and colleague on the other side of the aisle, Senator Lugar of Indiana, was in a tough primary battle with a more conservative candidate. And so,
and actually, as we speak, still is in that that primary problem, right?
Correct. May 8th is the, right. is the primary date. And so we think that the hearings have been delayed until Senator Lugar can put that primary behind him, win or lose. Mm-hmm. And then we suspect that Senator Kerry will then have more freedom to have hearings shortly after that May 8th primary. So that's why, once again, this zombie treaty is starting to come out of the grave.
It's back, as they say. All right, so let's talk a little bit about this treaty. It is, as you say, one that has been around for a long time. It has suffered a number of setbacks over the years. What does the treaty, the Law of the Sea Treaty, or LOST, do, Stephen Groves, and why should sensible people find it objectionable?
Well, sensible people should find it objectionable because of several provisions that would not advance U.S. interests and I think would harm U.S. interests. Now, there are parts of the treaty that are not controversial, and they're dealing with the navigational provisions, provisions that the Navy likes, provisions that they want, and these are provisions that the United States has followed closely, at least since the Reagan administration, when he decided not to sign the treaty. But sensible people should be concerned about the treaty because there are other provisions, like Article 82, which would require the United States to share oil and gas royalties with the developing world. And then there's a whole section of the treaty on dispute resolution, where the United States would be forced to defend itself against every baseless and specious international lawsuit that could be brought against it dealing with a maritime issue. And then there's just the idea
under circumstances, and I think this is really important to get across, Stephen Groves, under circumstances that amount to a rigged game, we've got really very little likelihood that our interests will be fairly adjudicated, let alone favorably so, by the kinds of, stacked deck that these guys are setting up for us in the Law of the Sea Tribunal and arbitration panels, right?
Correct. I mean, the arbitration tribunals will very, very likely result in a stacked deck against the United States because, for instance, in one of the tribunal formulations, the United States would get to select two of the five arbiters. The opposing party would get to select another two of the arbiters. But on the fifth crucial swing vote, if that arbiter cannot be agreed upon by the parties, which is very likely, then the person who gets to select that crucial swing vote is the United Nations Secretary General, who's not always keeping the best interests of the United States in his heart.
Yeah, I'd say that's rarely the case, in fact. All right, so Stephen Groves, one of the other pieces of this, and sovereignty is kind of the overarching problem, as I think we both agree with the Law of the Sea Treaty that Senator John Kerry, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, with the help of his friend, as you say, Senator Richard Lugar, the ranking minority member, but probably over the opposition of a fair number of members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, will try to move this thing forward again. But one of the other problems with it that strikes me as something that a lot of Americans should be concerned about in and out of Congress is the ability that the Law of the Sea Tribunal has asserted it has to exercise oversight and, in fact, impose regulations upon internal waters and air emanating from the inside of a country like ours. How does that work, and what would it mean, Steve Groves?
Well, it could mean significant economic disaster for the United States. And we're not just thinking about this hypothetically. The Law of the Sea Tribunals have already caused a lot of damage due to a case that Ireland brought against the United Kingdom several years ago, not because of something the United Kingdom was doing on the open seas or even on a river that would discharge into the ocean, but rather because it built a mixed oxide fuel reprocessing plant on its own territory, but it was close to the Irish Sea, and then Ireland's another 114 miles away, and they were able to successfully bring a lawsuit against the United Kingdom and tie up the commissioning of this mixed oxide fuel plant for years, costing untold number of dollars to the UK to defend the lawsuit, which was baseless. So, and brought the wrong tribunal with the wrong jurisdiction.
Yeah. In other words, if you are concerned about what the EPA, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, is doing at the moment to regulate your small businesses or your lives, for that matter, wait till these international bureaucrats, who are totally unaccountable to any of us, have us in their crosshairs, as they would once we ratified this treaty, should that actually happen. Stephen Groves, let me ask you one thing before we have to let you go. There is a new entrant into the rather large list of lobbyists, promoters, special interests and otherwise, including the United States Navy, I'm sorry to say. We were just speaking with the Navy League president. We hope to get him back to talk about this on another occasion, Stephen Groves. But one of the entrants in that list of lobbyists is none other than Trent Lott, who once upon a time, as I recall, was opposed to this treaty. What's going on there?
Yeah, this is a very, very disappointing development. Senator Lott, when he was in office, was adamantly opposed to U.S. Acceding to this treaty and made several statements, both in newspapers and on tape. We've got a great video of him at a press conference expressing his complete opposition. To the U.S. joining the treaty, but you know, since that time, he has gone over to the lobbying side of Washington D.C. and is employed by Shell Oil, who is in favor of the treaty, and so he's been going on the Hill and twisting arms in the Mississippi delegation and advocating for U.S. to join the treaty. So.
Is it a safe assumption that there is a lot more money on the side of getting us into this treaty than there is lobbying in opposition to it?
Well, there is a lot, pun intended, more money paid from Shell Oil
there you go.
Than there was when you were paid as a representative of the people of the state of Mississippi.
Yeah. You know, Stephen Groves, we have to let it go at this, but it just is it's kind of staggering to me that these oil companies, among other American businesses, think that they will actually prosper under an agreement that is, as you say, so stacked against them in lots of different ways, and we've only really just skimmed the surface. We look forward to visiting at greater length about this as Senator Lugar gets through his primary a week from today, and as the battle is joined once again. Stephen Groves will be one of the leaders in it. He is at the Heritage Foundation, where he is the Bernard and Barbara Lomas Fellow in its Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. Stephen Groves, thank you for the terrific work you personally do, and of course your esteemed organization does on all of these issues and more. We will be collaborating with you, I know, closely in the days ahead.
Thank you, Frank. We will need your help in the days ahead.
Next up, Reggie Littlejohn joins us to talk about Chen Guangcheng.
Want the big picture on national security and foreign policy? Find out what Ronald Reagan meant by peace through strength at securefreedomradio.org. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you.
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by one of the women that I have come to admire enormously. Her name is Reggie Littlejohn. She is the president of a group called the Women's Rights Without Frontiers, and she has been a real beacon for those who are concerned about human rights in China in general, and most especially what is one of the incalculably awful horrors of a still quite totalitarian regime, namely the one-child policy. And Reggie Littlejohn's work, I think, has been now put in a very important international light by virtue of Chen Guangcheng's miraculous delivery from his tormentors. This is a dissident who has been working on this, warning about this policy as well. And Reggie, it's so good to have a chance to chat with you, especially against the backdrop of this this intense scrutiny, I hope, on the problem that hasn't gotten enough of it of late. Tell us a little bit about Chen Guangcheng and his story and how it relates to the work that you all have been doing.
Thank you, Frank. Chen Guangcheng is famous for the fact that he exposed the massive and systematic use of coercion, particularly forced abortion and forced sterilization and infanticide in his city, Linyi City, in 2005. And there was a number that was an estimate of 130,000 forced abortions and forced sterilizations just in that city in 1 year. The Chinese Communist Party has boasted that they have prevented 400 million births through the one-child policy. That's greater than the entire population of the United States. And what Chen showed is that many of those prevented births were through forced abortion and forced sterilization. So for that, he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He was named by Time Magazine as one of their top 100 most influential people in the world, but he was also detained, imprisoned by the Chinese Communist Party for 4 years and 3 months, beaten, tortured, denied medical treatment, and then was under brutal and strict house arrest since September of 2010 when he was released, in which time they had, you know, 66 cadres surrounding the home, 22 every 8 hours, constant surveillance. They beat him and his wife brutally, even his mother, and almost starving from malnutrition. And he escaped absolutely miraculously a week ago Sunday.
I don't know that we've mentioned, either of us, that he's blind, which makes this all the more miraculous. But if we did, let me reemphasize it. This is unbelievable. And to the extent that he's now been delivered from this horror, and is ostensibly, at least we're told, in some sort of protective custody in the protection of American diplomats, we have the possibility that this story will get a lot more attention still. What's your understanding of the negotiations to try to affect his release or his asylum or something?
Well, I'll tell you what. The United States' response to this entire situation has been very disappointing. One of the top U.S. officials stated on Sunday on Fox News that the human rights situation regarding Chen Guangchen needs to be balanced against other U.S. interests. So it seems like that is in alignment with what Hillary Clinton said a couple of years ago, which is that we're not going to let human rights stand in the way of our focus on the economic relationship with China. And my feeling about that is the whole world is watching.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this news has been the top news ever since it came out last Friday. It's been on the front page of, you know, the Washington Post and New York Times. It was the top news on the Drudge Report all weekend. And the Chinese people and the people of the world are watching to see, what is the true value system of the United States? Do we really stand for human rights? Or are we willing to let even somebody of the noble character of Chen Guangchen, who is the Gandhi of our era, slip through because what we care about more than anything else is just the bottom line economically?
Yeah. Well, you say, Reggie Littlejohn, that this was very disappointing, the administration's behavior. Contrasting it with an earlier episode in which somebody sought asylum, it's a very different character to be sure, but nonetheless sought asylum in a U.S. consulate and was immediately turned over to the Chinese authorities. I guess we should be grateful for small favors, but the truth of the matter is this guy really is a saint for what he's been trying to do. And you know, as is your own work, saintly, in trying to help people understand what is really a moral abomination, as well as a genocide against particularly, you know, girls in China. Reggie, answer me this. I talked about this the other day with our colleague Gordon Chang, and he used this term bare branches to describe another component of this. If it's not bad enough that it involves this kind of genocide against female children, infants, it has some potential national security implications for the rest of us as well. What's the story there?
Well, actually, there's a new film that's going to be coming out in the fall called It's a Girl, and it's about gendercide in India and China. And according to one UN estimate, there have been 200 million girls who have been selectively aborted, which is greater than all the casualties of the major wars of the 20th century combined.
Yeah.
So this is the real war on women. I mean, people talk about the war on women in the United States having to do with, you know, contraceptive mandate. Guess what? The real war on women is, number one, forced abortion in China, in which women are dragged out of their homes and strapped to tables and forced to abort babies at 9 months, you know.
And sterilized not infrequently as well, right?
Forcibly sterilized, and then this gendercide, the sex selective abortion of baby girls.
Yeah.
China has the worst gender ratio of any country in the world. on average, it's 120 boys born for every 100 girls born. Mm. And that entire difference is due to sex-selective abortion. And what that's done is that it's created a situation in which there are an estimated 37 million bare branches, as you say, or extra men, as they would say demographically, excess males.
Tell me that number again.
37 million and rising, okay, because the gender ratios are not getting any better in China. They're adding about a million a year of these so-called excess males. And what that has done is two things. Number one, it is driving human trafficking and sexual slavery, not only within China, but from the surrounding nations. And number two, I think that there are domestic and international security implications. Domestically, when you have 37 million excess males, you see a rise in crime and potential social instability. And then internationally, when you have 37 million extra marriage-age men, those are also 37 million extra military-age men, and it can destabilizing influence internationally.
Well, at a minimum, they've got to be concerned. The Chinese Communist Party has got to be concerned that it can be a destabilizing force internally. And so I guess, Reggie Littlejohn, what we're almost certainly going to see is them trying to vent that, that appetite for women or at least a better life someplace else. Social engineering, it's been called, but it's a classic play of totalitarians to, vector it in an aggressive external way in order to try to ensure that there's not a problem at home. Do you see that translating into possible aggression, war, what have you, in the region or perhaps beyond in the foreseeable future?
That is the concern. And, if I were one of the nations that is surrounding China, I would be pretty nervous about these 37 million extra men.
Yeah, I will. And so should we, because many of them are our close allies, and indeed we have forces in quite a number of those regions. Reggie Littlejohn, you have, as I understand it, pushed out a petition on behalf of Chen Guangcheng. Tell us what that's about and how can people participate in it?
Well, my website is womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org, womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org. And right there on the homepage, towards the top right, you can see a button that says sign the Chen petition. It's a petition to free Chen Guangcheng. It's addressed to the Chinese Communist Party, which is appropriate because apparently Chen does not want asylum. He doesn't want to come to the United States. He wants to live freely within his own nation.
And continue his work.
Yeah, and we have something like 9,800 signatures right now, and I would love it to go over 10,000 this week so that we can present them with a petition with 10,000 signatures.
It certainly should, and I encourage everyone to go to womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org, check out the petition, sign it, and support the work of Reggie Littlejohn and her team. This is really not just in the interest of people suffering under this one-child policy, but very much ours as well. Reggie, thank you so much for joining us. Keep it up and come back to us again soon. Next up, Eric Schmidt of the New York Times joins us to commemorate and reflect upon the taking down of Osama bin Laden and whether the war on terror is actually over or not. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program.
But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and
listen. I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Eric Schmidt. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, covering a very important beat for the New York Times. He is the duty guy at the Pentagon for the New York Times and has been for quite some time. With his colleague Tom Shanker, he has written an important book called Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. And Eric, I can't help to take advantage of your being with us to remember the day a year ago today when we were first told that Osama bin Laden had been eliminated by SEAL Team 6. You've written extensively, both for the newspaper and in your book with Tom Shanker, about Al-Qaeda. We're hearing that takedown was a very big deal, especially as an integral part of an effort to eliminate what's now being called core Al-Qaeda. Tell us a little bit about where you think things stand now with this this war against Al-Qaeda.
Sure, and thank you for having me on again, Frank. I think, obviously, the death of bin Laden just a year ago punctuated the decline of what they call core Al-Qaeda, that is, course, the al-Qaeda leadership that organized, trained, and then executed the attacks on 9/11 against New York City, Washington, and, of course, the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. The good news here, of course, is that with the death of bin Laden and a couple of other key lieutenants in the past year, that core group of al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan, their ability to attack the United States in a major attack such as the 9/11 strikes is greatly diminished. These guys are on the run. There are really only maybe two figures left, Zawahiri and another key lieutenant, who have the kind of sway and pull anywhere near some of the other top leaders that were under bin Laden for many years. So that's the good news, is that that core group is under great pressure, particularly from the drone attacks the United States has carried out in the tribal areas and continues to do so, albeit at a slightly lower rate. The not-so-good news is that the affiliates, that is the franchises that al-Qaeda has been grooming and nurturing over the last 10 years, have come back to becoming even a bigger problem, and arguably even a bigger problem than they were a year ago. You have resurgent movements in North Africa, al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, including a kind of offshoot group called Boko Haram, which is an Islamic group in Nigeria that is working closely, apparently, with AQIM. Mm-hmm. You've had a coup in Mali. That's given that al-Qaeda franchise much more open space to develop perhaps areas of attack against the United States and the West. You've had a resurgent al-Qaeda in Iraq. Yep. It's not only carrying out strikes there, but also is reaching into Syria and trying to insinuate itself there separate from the opposition.
Yes.
You have Shabaab in Somalia, which is on somewhat on the decline. And then perhaps the most worrisome, the affiliate in Yemen. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which, of course, was the organization that was responsible for the so-called underpants bomber, the young man who tried to blow himself up over Detroit two Christmases ago, and then 2 months later packed explosives into printer cartridges. But for an intelligence tip from the Saudis, that could have been a disaster, too, in terms of having cargo planes blow up against the United States. In addition to that, though, Frank, I think in something we've talked about before, you still have a very resilient al-Qaeda ideology.
Mm-hmm.
That is, what they're trying to do is still motivate particularly young men across North Africa and the Middle East to join jihad, whether it's in small cells or what they might do. And, of course, they're also trying to reach into the United States and radicalize Americans, either to come and train in places like Yemen or use online videos from people like Anwar al-Awlaki, who was the American-born cleric who was killed in Yemen in a drone strike just over a year ago.
Right.
So there's definitely still a threat out there. It's more dispersed. It's more atomized, but it still is a threat.
Eric Schmidt, let me just ask you. We had last week a statement from a State Department senior, albeit unnamed State Department official, quoted by the National Journal, as you know, that it would seem in the face of that litany that you've just given us, and it's quite impressive and comprehensive and depressing, would be preposterous, namely that the war on terror is over, as this individual said. Before we get to the ideology, just on what basis do you think we could safely take that to the bank?
Well, I don't think we can. In fact, John Brennan, the president's counterterrorism advisor, gave a speech yesterday in Washington where he was addressed that head-on and said the war is not over. They've made great strides. The U.S. and the West and its allies have made great strides in taking down many of the key al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan. But to be sure, just as I just ticked off, there's still an array of threats. Again, they're more regionally based, but there's still several that are still have the United States and the West in their sights.
In their crosshairs. Yeah. And that brings me to the question about the ideology, and you've called it the al-Qaeda ideology, and I wonder whether, in fact, Eric Schmidt, the ideology is really something that is much more broadly shared within a cohort of folks who perhaps would call themselves jihadists. Certainly they are adherents to what they call Sharia. And I just wonder whether we have kind of been misled, whether intentionally or otherwise, into thinking that even the liquidation of some key elements of so-called al-Qaeda core is against all of this other stuff that is still very much with us. We're making the kind of progress that we're being encouraged to believe we are.
Well, I think even American officials would acknowledge that we haven't made the kind of progress against the ideology, the counter-messaging, however you want to describe it, as they have in the fight on the ground. It's a lot easier to kind of kill and capture bad guys than it is to dissuade them and from their ideology that they truly believe in. You're right. It's very hard for an American, particularly if it's an American president or American general, whoever, to say anything that's going to have credibility with the Muslim street or those who believe that. So it really is up to Muslims to combat this ideology.
Right.
They're the ones who are credible in their own world. And I think the U.S. has done a better job, although they still can improve, in trying to amplify those voices without making it seem like those people are stooges of the United States mm-hmm. and the West. That's the danger, of course, you run in trying to publicly back any of these individuals or organizations. They could just be labeled by the extremist groups as lackeys of the yeah. United States.
Well, the other danger, which we elaborate on at considerable length in a course that I've just mentioned to you off air, Muslim Brotherhood in America, The Enemy Within, which can be found, again, folks, at MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com, talks about another very serious danger, and that is that we may actually be embracing or extolling or otherwise legitimating people who, when all is said and done, fundamentally share Al-Qaeda's ideology, that Sharia doctrine. They may be in the pre-violent mode rather than the violent mode. And Eric Schmidt, I guess what I'm interested in sort of your thought on is we've been watching the U.S. government under the Obama administration embracing the Brotherhood, most notably, of course, in Egypt. How does that look now, better part of a year on, in terms of how the investment we've been making, in some cases actually substantial amounts of cash, as well as political legitimacy, how is it turning out, do you think, on the ground in Egypt?
Well, it's still very much a work in progress, Frank, and I think what you've seen is the administration trying to walk a very fine line between supporting democracy, small d, and you know the Western principles of democracy, but also acknowledging that you have very popular and populist movements now in many of these so-called Arab Spring countries, Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt being first and foremost. I think what you've seen, though, is even within the Brotherhood, you've seen different voices, some calling for moderation now that they are in a position of power, and suddenly it's realizing, you know, to govern a country like Egypt with all its problems, you have to come up with solutions or the people will throw you out, just like they will any other elected government. And it, frankly, as it turns out, the Muslim Brotherhood may not be the most extremist element in Egypt. You have Salafists who are now even more extreme than they are. And so here's the administration, you know, doing the best it can, I think, to kind of help push and stir the American interest there without having a backlash that you have in so many other Arab countries. So it's a very fine line of walking and trying to recognize the potential for problems that you've identified here, but also recognizing this is a popular movement. You don't want to get too far behind it. And if they're going to fail, you want to have them fail and not have the excuse, well, the United States was the one who undermined us.
Yeah.
So there's something we need to learn from past years.
Eric, we will be following these stories with you closely as you report at the New York Times on them, and I hope here periodically from the vantage point of Secure Freedom Radio. We appreciate you spending a little bit of time with us. I hope you're right that the administration is walking this fine line well and that what we're getting is not really just simply a bait and switch that turns out to be a pretty immoderate group of people with our interests nowhere near their hearts. Thank you so much for your insights, especially on this day, this anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden. We look forward to visiting with you again in the future on what is happening with this so-called war on terror and the civilization jihad piece as well. We look forward to talking with the rest of you as well tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.